session number 9483, reel 7.
Mr. Templar, reel 7.
So, Mr. Templar, you're on leave and you've gone into a tea room in Kingsway.
Oh, yes. We'd been to see a play, I think it was Chu Chin Chow or something equally funny. And we took all the girls with us until we saw a restaurant we liked. There was John and I and umpteen ladies. And we saw this restaurant, it looked very nice, so we all trooped in with John and I in the at the head. And sitting at the table, not far from the entrance, was our colonel. He also on leave. And John and I came to an abrupt halt, gave him a very smart salute, and he said, "I'm glad to see you're enjoying yourself, boys." We said, "Thank you, sir." And we went off to the girls and sat down and got some tea. And eventually, when we'd had our tea and we were ready to go, we got up, but he'd already gone. I suppose he thought it'd be advice for him to get clear. But that was a very happy occasion.
Did you get on particularly well with your colonel? Did you have a good
relationship? Oh, I don't know about getting on with him. I think he was very very interested in me as an NCO, and especially as an NCO in the signals. And it was more or less a fluke that I wasn't a sergeant at that time, but that I've already described.
So you would actually have quite a lot of contact with the colonel?
Well, it was all... it was one of respect, obviously. Mm. And he was treated as the commanding officer there, and all the officers were treated that they were in their, according to their rank. But there is a certain personality interest in people. And I think he was interested in me particularly, because I'd been given stripes against all, you know, I knew nothing about the army. And I was very glad to be in the signal section, which was a job which was much better than the ordinary rank and file, because you were regarded as a specialist in the battalion, and you had to behave and act and do your job in that capacity.
Would you actually have much to do with the colonel on a day-to-day basis? Would you see him more often than
I would see him quite frequently, especially when we were in the line, because I had messages to take and deliver to him and get instructions as to what to reply to. We were always in communication with divisional headquarters when we were on the canal bank and elsewhere, but there were times when we were on the move, of course, there was no telephone communication. I mean, radio, such as we know it now, was not even contemplated then. So that it was a rather personal relationship, although I was a mere NCO. But it doesn't alter the fact that you can sense whether a man is interested in you as an individual and has a certain feeling that you're a reliable individual. That's the important factor.
Do you have any other recollections from that leave?
No, except that a certain lady was all at my side for the whole of the period. And if it's the leave I'm talking about, 1917... There was an incident that came later. Anyway, I can talk about in the 1918 period for that.
Do you remember what the shows were on at the theatres?
Oh, no, I don't.
Were they patriotic shows, or were they shows that would take your mind?
They were rather light-hearted shows very often. I mean, we went to be amused, not to be bored, and it was dependent on how the ladies concerned what they wanted to see as well as what we wanted to see. They were only interested in doing what they thought we wanted, you see. But it was rather an exciting time, especially for a couple of youngsters like John and I. I mean, at that time, 1917, how old would I have been? 22, 23.
Do you remember what time of year it was when you were back on leave?
Usually towards the autumn or somewhere about that
period. September, October.
Yes, that was when the winter period was about to set in, and probably a lot of warfare will stagnate.
So there was a feeling that nothing much more was going to happen on the front?
Well, you don't know about that, but the point was that that was the time that it occurred that you got to your leave. And it was always about that time, you see, and even in 1918, although I was hit in the early part of 1918, I didn't come home on leave until October 1918, you see.
So you return to France
from
probably about October
1917. It might have been a bit later, because it was, I think if I remember rightly, that was the time when we were up on the canal bank again, and John wanted to fix up a little bit of extra tasty rations, which we have already referred to in an earlier stage of these tapes.
On your return to France on this occasion, you've been in the army for
nearly three years.
What was your attitude towards the army and the war? Had it changed significantly over that
time? I don't think so. In those days, you've got to remember that Britain was a power, and a world power of its class. And we, as young Englishmen, were volunteered. We offered ourselves. We knew the risks. We knew that we might be killed or maimed or anything. But because we didn't want to be overrun by anyone else, we were prepared to fight for it. And therefore, you went abroad with a certain excitement. It was a big adventure, for one thing. And after all said and done, when you're young, that is a time for adventure. And you took everything as it came. If you suffered hardship, well, it was something we'd expected to do. I mean, baths and things like that were not common. We very often had to wash ourselves as we possibly could with a pail of cold water. You know, and therefore, when we had an occasion that we were allowed to go into a brewery that had once been operating and find that they got plenty of hot water and there was only half tubs or showers, you had to get into a half tub of hot water and bathe yourself. It was quite a treat.
Whereabouts was that?
Not far from the line. I forget where it was, somewhere probably on the outskirts of the of Belgium, I forget now.
And would that be shared by company or by battalion?
The whole battalion had a dip that day, and they were all very frisky. It's different to having a pail of water and shaving with cold water every day.
Had conditions improved at all over the 3 years, or had they?
I don't know that you could compare it at all. It's impossible. After all said and done, we were fed. And equipped and kept. We were kept equipped, and we were just soldiers. We knew that the rations came up every night, or the ambulances came up during the evening or dark and took any wounded away or sick people. There were a number every night, and the postman of the battalion used to come up with the ration limbers. Well, it was all horse drawn or mule drawn. And he'd bring mail up and would be dished out to us in our various parts of the dugouts or the line, whichever we were in.
Had your signalling equipment developed over those 3 years?
No. Towards the end of the time, a new type of telephone was introduced called the Fuller phone, if I remember rightly. And I think that had some protective overriding component which protected it from some of the picking up that it was possible through the telephone lines laying on the ground, you see, which produced their own inductance area, which could, if with a sophisticated thing that we have nowadays, they'd all be able to be picked up through the ground. But the Fuller phone, but I mean, I never had much to do with them. The war came to a conclusion.
Well, so this was in 1918?
Towards the 1918 area, that would have been.
But otherwise, your equipment and your techniques and so forth remained much the same?
Much the same. We were given tin hats, you know, steel helmets, I should say. in the end of 19, towards the end of 1916 or during 1916, and we also supplied with a new respirator which had a container which fitted on our chest, a mask, and just elastic clips which went over the head to keep the mask and the mouthpiece in position. And that was with the air you breathe actually came, was brought, drawn in through the contents of the respirator.
That seemed to be an improvement over the previous
one. Oh, it was, well, it was much better than the ordinary, the old gas helmet which went right over the head. And you had a mouthpiece, and if anything happened, it got torn, you were done for, you see. So that didn't happen then. But the mask was very much better. But that came in the early part of 16, I think.
Was it comfortable to wear?
Oh, you could wear it, yes. It had goggles, you see, and they steamed up a bit, but then you got over all those sort of difficulties. Anyway, that's it.
So, anyway, back in France, 1917, are you back on the canal bank again?
No. We were moved out towards the end of 17 of the line. I can't think where, which part of the line we were in at the time. But I was trying to remember the name of the wood, Bois de Boulogne, the wood of the wood of Boulogne, Bois, Bois de Boulogne. With some part of that, there was a village there which we arrived at, and as I was on advance party again, I was sent ahead with. I forget whether there was an officer with us or not, or whether I was just sent with a number of other ranks to arrange billets for the officers. They were moved into a chateau in this particular village, and the headquarters signals were put into a barn, which was in the grounds of the chateau. It was a wall all round the area of the chateau. And there was a guard tent in the grounds which had a brazier out at night, and of course all sentries were mounted with loaded weapons. So that, but that's where the battalion settled sometime towards the end of 1917. When the advance party got there, I had several different NCOs with me, and the Mari of the village, the mayor, said there are plenty of deer in the woods here, and he said bon pour shoot, which meant you can go out and shoot them. So we had one or two parties out shooting deer, and it became rather extraordinary, because I was out with one party and we bumped into the colonel as we were going up with our rifles under our arm, and he said, what, this is a hunting party, boys? And we said, yes, sir. And he didn't stop us, so we went on. But I don't think we got any deer that night. They were too timid, and there were too many of us and made too much noise. But there was a lot of shooting, not only from the party that I was in, but one or two other groups had got out looking for deer, and I think they did get one. But there was a complaint after that, that bullets from... because our rifles were very powerful, and they'd bullets travelled a long way. A village about 1.5 miles away or a mile away complained that a lot of bullets kept passing through it and hitting buildings and that sort of thing, and there was quite a song and dance about it in the village. However, we enjoyed ourselves on that leave, and of course that was when the then sergeant of the signal section, who was had been a lance corporal and was pushed in front of me by D Company commander, really excelled himself. He used to get drunk every night and left me to look after the section.
What was his name?
His name at that time was Sergeant Bill Ayton, William. But he was a fellow who was rather notorious, because he was very addicted to plenty of drink. And he also liked the ladies, because before we left England he used to have one or two favourite housekeepers and cooks in various of the local houses, who he applied his particular type of fascination, and they used to keep him well stocked up with food and eggs, which he gulped down in raw to keep him going. Anyway, He was the fellow who was made full corporal at the time when our commanding officer, the colonel, was on leave. And I've told you about that. But the point is that he was then corporal and he was getting drunk, and I was the, as corporal signaller, I was the senior NCO in the barn, which was on the top floor of the barn, a very big, large barn over the whole barn building. And I was up there. There was a cot in a little cubicle in what might have been adjacent to a table or something, with a wire net cot in there, and that's where the sergeant was allowed to sleep when he wanted to. And one night he came in completely tight, and I and all the boys were upstairs. We only got candles there, they were alight, and it was getting near lights out. About lights out, he came in, and he called up, "Charlie, I want to speak to you." So I said, "Go get in your cot and go to sleep, you know." And instead of that, he decided he wanted to come up and talk to me. So he climbed up the ladder, which was placed at the opening of a trap door. The trap door part of it had disappeared. And he got out and he said, "Charlie, where are you? I want to talk to you." I said, "Why don't you go down and behave yourself?" And then somebody along that floor, there were, I suppose, about 40 men up there of various ranks, lance corporals and that sort of thing. And there was an empty 5-gallon drum standing near the aperture of the trap door. And he picked it up. He said, "I hate cats." And he started to swing it about. So I yelled out, "Shut up." And I got out of my blankets. "Be quiet, everybody."
So someone was imitating a cat?
Yes. And I was attempting to go get to him. Because in those days, we didn't strip off entirely. We just took anything off that we didn't want to sleep in. And so I was probably got pants and undershirt on or something. And I started to make my way over to where the silly man was standing. And somebody behind me meowed very loudly. And he swung this oil drum round and let it go in the direction of where the meow had come from. And it landed just on the pack of that we all, you know, John's pack. He'd been sleeping with his head on it, same as everybody else. And it would have been him. He meowed, and it landed where his head had been. And I jumped forward, and I cracked Billy hard on the jaw. And he went down, and it knocked him out. So I turned back to John, and I said, "You are, you know, see? You trying to get me stripped, I could have lost my stripe for striking a senior NCO." And, of course, everybody got a bit subdued then, so I went back to find Billy still unconscious. So I sent a man down this ladder, and I said, "Hang on, I'll lower him down to you." So I grabbed Billy by the collar. The man went down the ladder. I got his legs over the opening and lowered him down. And the legs were grappled with by the fellow who was down below. And then I hung on to him and went down the ladder myself, holding his collar. Then we put him in his cot. The next morning, we covered him up with a blanket, blew his candle out and left him. He was asleep then. So I got a big can of tea, one of the small mess tins, and took it into him and said, "Here you are, Billy, have a drink of tea." And he woke up and he groped and got the mess tin and he went to drink it. And he said, "Christ, my bloody jaw is sore." I said, "I'm not surprised. You were drunk as a noodle last night." I said, "What have you been up to?" He said, "I don't know. I can't remember a damn thing." However, that was it. He drank the tea, and in a few minutes he was as woozy as ever because he'd been drinking cognac. So I left him to get on with it, and I went back upstairs and got dressed. And then, shortly afterwards, I had a message sent from the orderly room that I was to place Sergeant Aidan under arrest and bring him up before the colonel at 9 o'clock. So I went down to Billy and I said, "What the hell have you been up to?" And I said, "You better you better pull yourself together, clean yourself up and sober up, because you're going to be taken to before the colonel at 9 o'clock and I've got you under arrest. So what did you do? Did I know? He didn't know a thing. However, we took him up and he was marched in, and the colonel gave him a reprimand, very severe, stripped him of one stripe, said he was reduced to a corporal, and instructed me to put the third stripe up. I became a sergeant straight away, which was just as well for things, because he was no good as an NCO at all. However, that was the story there. What he had done, he'd come in his drunken way, and he'd been challenged by the sentry on duty. The guard were in a bell tent with a brazier, which was an oil drum with holes knocked in it and a lot of coal or wood in it. And he'd been challenged by the sentry, you know, presenting the rifle and bayonet at him. And he'd snatched the rifle and bayonet from the sentry and shoved it at the sentry and forced him back in the tent. Then kicked the brazier in on top of the lot of them. And then at that moment, as he turned away, he bumped into the colonel who was riding in on a bicycle and knocked him off. That was
a good evening.
Have I told you that before?
No.
Shop it off.
What's the sentry?
He could have shot him.
Well, the sentry lost his gun and bayonet.
Well, he saw this fellow reeling about, and he yelled the bayonet, and Billy Ayton must have grabbed it and pushed it away and pulled it out of his hand. See, and then he turned it round and said, get in a bloody twin sort of thing.
But couldn't the sentry have been accused of dereliction of duty?
No, not under those circumstances. No, because he was an NCO who was known to him. See? He was drunk, obviously. But you can't be accused of not sticking your bayonet in a man just because he's drunk, you know? No, anyway, that was what happened, and I became sergeant then. Of course, and then a few days afterwards we moved off and came into our last big fight against the last big German attack.
Could you tell me a little bit about the routine during these rest periods when you were taken away from the line?
Well, sometimes there would be some sort of training exercise or physical exercise, you know. But by and large, it was a time when the boys could go and have a drink if they wanted it, but they had to stay around because we were only away from the communication trench area and always there, available, in case there was a sudden attack and we might have to be rushed up to the front again.
So how far back from the line would you have been withdrawn?
It would depend where they wanted to get rid of us, you see. Sometimes it was way back. I know there was one that we used to go to called Zegerskapelle, and I can't tell you how far that was, but it was a march, you see. But it doesn't alter the fact that we were troops available for whatever we were called upon to do. During that time, you had a rest out of the front line area, do you see. There was not much shelling right back. An occasional big shell had come over, and, you know, when they were trying to hit communications like roads and that, they'd make a hell of a thing, and they were high-velocity shells they used then. You didn't really know they were arriving until they hit you, you see. If you heard it, you were lucky. It was going somewhere else.
So how long would you be on these rest periods?
Your guess is as good as mine.
So
might be a matter of a week or two, but not very long. But it was just to give the boys a rest from the constant dodging of bits of shrapnel and things like that.
And how often would this happen?
God knows. No, I mean, it's a question that is impossible. It happened according to the instructions of the higher command, the divisional commander. They arranged all these things.
So there was no routine that you would have a certain period of rest and then a certain
period? Oh, no, there was no routine about it. It was purely and simply based upon, I imagine, the activity of the Germans in that time. If the Germans got busy, then we should have been rushed into it. But if they didn't, then the Germans had to be arrested too.
Following the period of rest in the Bois de Boulogne, where were you posted to next?
Well, we moved out of that the Bois de Boulogne area, and we went back to for a few days, or an odd week or two, to a sector south of Ypres. And then suddenly we started marching. We were ordered to go south. And after we had a long route march, covering several days, during which we had to sleep where we could. Very often, and on one occasion I remember, we were moved into what had been a chateau, but had been rather had the floorboards ripped out for fires. It was in a terrible condition. And we had to sleep on the ground floor on what was a concrete slab, you know. Where all the other people were sleeping, I don't know. But during that night, there were gaps in the ceiling where the plaster had all given way, and there were just floorboards where a lot of boards had been ripped out, obviously, to make fires. And that was above our heads. So we rolled up in our blankets on concrete, and the lights out. You know, we only had candles, so they were all blown out, and we decided to go to sleep. During the night, there must have been hundreds of rats about the place, because they all assembled on the upper floor immediately over us. And they started racing from one end of this very long room to the other. And they seemed to be having races. And all of a sudden, they go from that way, and galloping along, and then they come back. And on their return journey, there'd be a gap in the floor and ceiling, you see, so that one of them, or more than one, would fall through onto the fellows down below, and there'd be a shout and a curse and you bloody thing, you know. And that it went on for a long time, because these bloody rats were everywhere. However, the next morning relieved us, because we were still whole. They hadn't eaten any of us.
So this would be
on the way down to
towards
the south.
January 1918.
This would be, yes, in the early part of 1918, because we arrived, and it was a long march, because what did we do then? About 20 or 30 kilometres a day, probably, under those conditions, full marching order and equipment. the actual period of time it took, I don't know. It means I can't tell you exactly what happened in the south of Ypres. And therefore you got to accept that it was a long route march, and we got down to a place just east of Elbeur, where there was a statue of the Virgin Mary cocked over to an angle from the dome. Virgin Mary and child.
So is that Bethune?
No, it was at Elbeur, the Elbeur Cathedral, A-L-B-E-R-T, Cathedral, and we could see it. And there was a legend there that if that fell before the war had finished, the Allies would have lost.